It's Sunday, which means it's time for Viewpoint Presents with Malcolm and Michael Johns. Each week, we bring you the top global and national news stories presented with facts and top-tier analysis, all from a perspective rooted in America's founding principles. Join us in defending our great nation and American liberty. Now, here's Malcolm and Michael with the week's top stories.
Well, there are several big factors setting this election up for to be an election like we haven't seen before. And the big story here this week, my friends, is you hear the president come out with that tweet and, put the obvious facts out there that people really don't want to hear or talk about it. Well, we'll talk about it today here as we join you here, Malcolm and Michael Johns. So it's good to be with you. Now, on Viewpoint Presents, we're going to take on the election here big time today. Also talk about John Lewis, Herman Cain, two great Black Americans that have passed on now. We want to talk about that. But also this election, a lot of voter fraud possibilities, big tech, how do they weigh into all of this? And of course, people, the narrative that never stops, and that is the media and their influence on these things. And you know, Michael and I were just talking off mic about that exactly. These are two things, Michael, that never seem to are going to change. And that is, like the media and big tech and how they weigh in to these elections. And I know people are pretty juiced about it, but listen, this is kind of the hand of cards that has been dealt now, and we have to deal with it, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way the world is in 2020. Maybe that's not the way it is in 2030, but as for now, you got to deal with the world the way it is. I think, you know, if you're a conservative or a patriot, any sort of right of center political perspective, you kind of have to look and realize that over the last 30 years, we've allowed this very radicalized progressive movement basically take over almost every key institution, influential institution in the country. And we have to take some responsibility for that and start trying to claw our way back into mainstream relevance in these institutions. And it's going to take a lot of work.
Listen, at the end of the day, you can sit and complain all day long or sit on the sidelines griping about everything that is wrong or not fair. And I hear that a lot from people. It's not fair. Well, my message back is that life isn't fair, really, and it's what you make of it. And so, Michael, the point we bring up here, I think, is an important one, is that, and I like what you say, actually, when you say, well, listen, it may be that in 2020, but it doesn't have to be that way in 2030. And I think important to say that, people, because what that creates is opportunities. It really does create some tremendous opportunities for people that are paying attention. And quite frankly, as we were just discussing, this is the whole impetus for what we do here and what my whole motive and movement is at America Out Loud, and is to really bring the voices and the awareness to the American people. Now, having said all that, there are several big factors that are going to weigh in on this election. And let me just go through the mic with you. How the president has handled the pandemic, definitely he's going to be judged on that. No question about it. You know, who will they blame for the violence and civil unrest? That's definitely a major factor in this election. Our relationship with China, another major impact, and potentially the biggest one of them all, as always, is going to be the economy. And remember, Americans have short memories, Michael. They may not remember the good moments, which were just a short many months ago, but they certainly will remember what we're going through now, which is part and parcel of the problem as to why the left is trying to not open the country back up and trying to economic. And I'm seeing a lot of the media outlets really play to the election and blame the economy on the president. But these are the major areas I see going into the election.
Yeah, I think you hit them, and you raise an important question, which we'll get to here a little later on the vast accomplishments that this president had. I mean, when you're looking at this race in December of 19 or January of 20, it was an entirely different political narrative, and the assessment of it was completely different than it's going to be now. As it relates to your questions, how do the American people feel about coronavirus? I'm of the opinion, as I think I've mentioned in some of our past shows, that this president has to get out in front make sure the American people are aware that he's taking ownership of this issue, even though it was not his fault. That blame lies on China. That needs to be, I think, drilled home as well, and show both compassion and leadership. And I don't think there's any shortage of either in this administration. I know how hard they've been working on this. It's a 24/7 undertaking. Yeah. And every decision that this president's made on it has been really pretty calculated and pretty impressive. I mean, you start with the travel ban, you go on with all of the demand about the ventilators, which was overstated, that he addressed the mass mobilization of equipment and health facility and hospital space, and then the therapeutics, and this vaccine has all the promise based on testimony over the past week of being approved in record speed. It's kind of like on a federal level, I think we've done everything that can be done. And then yet when you break it down on a state level, the results are more mixed, with, you know, some really bad early decisions on nursing home admissions for these patients, which spread, contributed to thousands of deaths, probably, almost certainly, and then their own unpreparedness for this, you know, basically, which was what created the demand on the federal government to fill the gap.
Well, I think one of the things I believe you really cannot argue with, although they do try to do this, Michael, and that is this: the president always, to me, does what's best for the American people. I mean, you can say what you want, but the takeaway I get from all of these things, including the things you just said with shutting a lot of the borders down, limiting travel, the early pandemic measures that he put in place, which, by the way, and I think it is important to remind people, the left and the Democrats were not happy about. You recall that Pelosi went to Chinatown and started to talk about everything is cool right in the city. What are you people worried about? Well, you know, I mean, they weren't taking it serious then, but nobody finds fault to that or goes back to play those tapes again, because, again, why? Because the media is in the tank for the left. They want them to win this election. We know all that. Everybody should know that. That's not a secret.
Well, and can remember, if you think back about January 31, the president makes that decision pretty unilaterally, apparently even over the advice of some of his closest policy and political counselors.
That's right.
And no one's really on board with it. You know, so the media views it negatively. Wall Street, as you recall, had a really negative reaction to it, and the market corrected substantially. All those gains have been regained since, but you know, they viewed it negatively. China, of course, criticized it. And Joe Biden, to your point of reminding American people where people were at that moment, described the president's decision to keep coronavirus out of this country as being racist and xenophobic. That's and right. I believe that was an important judgment call by these two individuals that are aspiring to be the president for the next year, 4 years. And it should really reflect. I mean, one, Donald Trump had it 100% right, was even ahead of the curve against all of this institutional criticism. And the other kind of fell in line with what people wanted to hear, what they thought was fashionable, and which, of course, had he been president at that time, would have been immensely deadly. And I'd like to see a little more reporting on that. Like, what would the ramifications have been clinically, like from a mortality rate, from a exposure rate, from, you know, the magnitude of the pandemic, had Joe Biden gotten his way and allowed Wuhan citizens to continue to enter the United States till at what point would he ever have even changed his mind? No one's asked that question. He's been thrown these softballs. It's sickening for educated political people who are looking at it, that these are questions that are not asked. I think the question should be said: you called it racist and xenophobic on January 31. At what point did you consider it not racist and not xenophobic and actually a pretty good idea?
The sad part about it is nobody is going to report on the things that Michael and I are talking about right now, and the fact that you're right. Those comments from the Speaker of the House and from the presidential candidate was the typical go-to argument, that the president is a racist, xenophobe, sexist, whatever. That's their only argument they ever have. But yet, it was for the right reasons that he did what he did that saved countless deaths. and help. And, you know, nobody was really taking this serious early on. Certainly Biden and Pelosi were not. They weren't taking it serious at all. Like you said, there was kickbacks from China, Europe. Everybody was upset at the president. So the thing is, the takeaway is on all of this is the president will oftentimes make the unpopular decision and he'll do things. And I'll tell you what. Oftentimes he is by himself. And this is really the sign of a leader as well, what we're talking about right this moment. Only a leader is willing to go against the sheeple and go against the populace for that and really stand tall and say, you know what? This is what we have to do. Now, this president does this time and time again. Sometimes some people think to his own detriment, but you know what? In this particular case, he was doing the right thing, and as history will show, it was because of those actions. So I think it's important to say this because he is going to be judged on all of the things we're talking about right now, very much so. You know, there's been a lot of talk, too, about Fauci in the last couple of weeks. Of course, he was up talking to Congress as well, Michael, and I kind of factored in here a little bit as well because you know, a lot of people are not trusting Fauci. You know, remember, he is a Democrat himself. He obviously votes that way, and you see his politics and the way he lines up. And I think a lot of Republicans are losing favor with him and don't believe he's the right person for the job. And the president, I think, is trying to keep him arm's length away. But you kind of have to deal with some of these bureaucrats because they're there. It's not like he picked them, right?
At this point, you have to. I think in retrospect, which is never really all that politically advisable to get into, but in retrospect, a lot of these people should have been looked at on day one, you know, and assessed. I mean, this, you know, we talk about the swamp, this guy's been there for 45 years.
They've all been there forever.
Carter administration appointee. Yeah. I mean, that's unbelievable. I'm persuaded by the fact that, you know, you have, you know, a lot of individuals in the White House who've, you know, considered him to be wrong on a lot of these issues. And, yet he's the one who's continually celebrating, and he's still out, like, in front of media, basically saying things that in a lot of ways contradict the messages of the administration, which I think is confusing and politically dangerous. And I was very disappointed this past week. I thought Jim Jordan, the congressman from Ohio, who has
nailed him,
won the Freedom Caucus, which used to be the Tea Party Caucus, which is really so hugely important in Congress, asked the questions about these street, I don't know, we'll call them protests, riots, really,
riots.
At this point, the street riots, and whether those should be curtailed and whether the distancing policies that are, you know, should be enforced.
Well, I don't know. I don't talk about protests or riots.
But yet when it came to the Major League Baseball season, when it came to reopening sports, when it came to religious services, all of these things he had very vocal opinions about. And they were very conservative as it related to, you know, suggesting that great care should be used. Great care should be used in all of these things, including exercising First Amendment rights. But when it comes to these, you know, largely illegal street riots, which is what they are now, when you're burning property and hurting people and consciously trying to destroy things and set things on fire, you know, what would it not have been just reasonable to sort of say, you know, yeah, that you really, even from a public health standpoint, set aside all the politics, the rest of it, should not be out there doing that at this point. That's the guidance of the federal government of the United States. Right now, what is the federal government guidance of the United States as it relates to the public health dimension of these street riots? It's kind of mixed. And I don't think that's a message that we should be sending. And I do understand the predicament that this president's in on that. You can't terminate somebody like that in the middle of a crisis, which is why I always believe you get your personnel in line day one.
Well, listen, Jim Jordan did a hell of a job in putting Fauci to task. I know that many conservatives were standing up cheering, seeing that interaction, mostly because he calls people out for the truth. He wants the truth, and he doesn't allow you to escape the answer. He's a hell of a questioner and somebody that can really, you know, you got to be prepared if you're going to be in a firing squad or be confronted with a Jim Jordan. And I love the way you just say the early ons of the Tea Party, which is really what, to remind folks out there, Michael's origins of the whole Tea Party. That is the caucus, the Freedom Caucus, and it's the Tea Party and the connection back to Michael and his work as a co-founder of the Tea Party movement. Which, by the way, there's going to be a lot to that ahead, I promise you, because right now there's a lot of questions about the money we're spending and the bankrupting of our nation again, which is prime to this conversation we're having right now, because Pelosi wants to spend another $3-4 trillion. There is no limit of money these people will throw at a problem versus the Republicans are trying to keep it downwards of about a trillion. Again, we speak in terms now of trillions, not millions anymore, not billions. Soon it'll be trillions and gazillions, whatever. And there's a price to pay for all this that nobody's paying for. We'll come back to that. Yeah. I think that's going to be interesting, Michael, to your point ahead as the Tea Party. But listen, let's get to the big narrative right now. To me, the big bomb that went off in the room, I think we got to talk about right now. And that is, wow, wow, wow. I can just imagine the look on your face, Michael, when you seen the tweet that President Trump put out there on July 30th. That was Thursday. And it was an eye opener and it stopped everybody in their tracks. But you got to really zone into the tweet. Back to what you said, the president typically has a reason for doing these things. And we said that early on, you heard me talk about that on the program on the first hour of Viewpoint with Dr. Carol Swain. And it really was about the fact that, you know, the president throws this out there. And he typically has a strategic reason for doing so. Now, the tweet itself says this, and listen carefully here, with universal mail-in voting, and he puts in parentheses now, and this is something I want to educate everybody on today, and we'll talk about this later in the program even more, but the difference between mail-in voting and absentee voting, there is a major difference, people. But yet you listen to outlets like CNN and MS and The Times, and they don't want to talk about that difference at all. They want to stay on that one narrative is all they want to do, that it's all the same, that absentee voting is the same as a state throwing all these mail-out votes in there, and it's not the same. And that's right. A big point we need to talk about. But let me throw this at you here. So to finish this tweet, he says here, 2020 will be the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. It will be a great embarrassment to the USA. And then he throws this really firebomb in the room here. Delay the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote? Question mark, question mark, question mark. And I'll tell you what, that tweet, you heard the reaction was loud and swift from everybody, the media, including Republicans. What was your take on it when you seen the tweet and the reaction from the Republican establishment as well?
Well, as a matter of general principle, the election needs to be certified as free and fair to be considered definitive and final. And I think the president's position on this is the same as it was in 2016, that in an age where voter fraud, at least on local levels, has proven to be so profoundly challenging to the democratic political process, you wouldn't logically just say I'm going to accept any results until they're audited and certified. Constitution on this is very clear. There's no risk of the president, holding on to the White House if he loses the election in a free and fair election that's certified as fraud-free. But certainly that's an issue. That's why, the DNC and the RNC mobilized, dozens upon dozens of electoral attorneys all over the country to assess and litigate these things. It's become immensely complicated, and it would be even more so and more prone to fraud if it were a universal mail-in ballot, which has, you mentioned the New York Times. I'll just tell you, I'm a daily reader of the New York Times for better or worse, and have been for a long time. But, they've editorialized against the mail, saying that Trump's overstating the risks of the mail-in voting, that this is just scare tactics, and it's an exaggeration, of course, the usual kind of left of center line. And then I'm like, well, I was kind of curious how they might have reported on some of the documented cases of legitimate fraud, of which there's many. Almost every place where this mail-in approach has been taken, there's examples of this. Started digging a little further. I'm like, here's a headline from last few weeks, mail carrier in West Virginia pleads guilty to attempted election fraud. That's a New York Times article in the same paper that said editorializing through is no such problem. July 17th, New York Times. 3 weeks after primary, New York officials still can't say who won key races. Tens of thousands of absentee ballots in New York are still uncounted, and races have yet to be called. What will November look like? That was the headline. And this New York 12 race, the congressional district, New York 12, held by Carolyn Maloney, had you know, still like 800 of 65,000 absentee ballots tabulated, to which if you're covering that race, and you could see it in the coverage of it, New York Times are very frustrated. And part of the problem is that the absentee ballots are up hugely in New York City. 400,000 absentee ballots were filed in this primary versus 66,000 in the 2008 New York City primary. So, you know, that's a factor of about fivefold over what it was in 2008, which obviously is, they're just simply not situated, prepared. That infrastructure does not exist. It won't exist in November either.
Yeah. And, you know, the more you dive into this topic that you hear Michael and I talking about right now, people, the more you dive into this, the more I hear it in my ears from a lot of Republicans, conservatives who have said consistently they are very concerned with the integrity of this election and with voter fraud. And then when you see the president come out with that tweet and so many other things that have taken place, you begin to realize that this is a real question mark. It's not just hypothetical, people. I mean, seriously, and I've got a lot of facts I want to talk about ahead with Michael and bring you folks up to speed with some of the real challenges of this universal mail-in voting, where the state just sends a ballot out to everybody, including dead people, by the way. Viewpoint Presents continues. Be back after this quick pause.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
AmericaOutLoud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Well, as we celebrate our 4-year anniversary, thank you for making it all possible. We are a grassroots movement of patriots, blogs, podcast, video, and 24/7 talk radio on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We are the vision of the voices, America Out Loud Talk Radio. Well, our nation has lost two big Black American voices, and John Lewis, Representative Lewis, and Herman Cain, the business extraordinaire, and both have passed on now. And so let's talk about both of those next here. Interestingly, the Lewis, what I think is so remarkable, Michael, about this story here, and listen, to keep it all fair and straight here, there have been a lot of people that have been very critical because there's been no outcry from a large gathering of the funeral services and all of the people they've had collectively get together that they have allowed. And there's certain things, in other words, they allow because of the pandemic, and certain things they don't. And this one was totally green-lighted, not to take anything away from it. But I do think that is a point to mention. A lot of people are upset about that, quite frankly.
It was more hypocrisy, frankly. I mean, you know, the D.C., I think, has been incredibly strict about these quarantine measures, 14 days that they require, and have put a lot of people through the inconvenience of going through that in the interest of the public health. And then here you have all these individuals who fly down to Atlanta in what was had a lot of exposure to a lot of people in a short period of time, and come back to D.C. and are exempted by the mayor from having to go through the 14
I was going to say, were all those people quarantined, Michael?
No, I'm saying the mayor, D.C. mayor exempted them.
Right. So how fair is that? Listen, I just read stories yesterday that people were put in jail. People were put in jail because they didn't do the 14 days, Michael. They were out walking their dog.
Hey, look, I was reading another example this past week in D.C. of some pro-life protesters who had apparently had routinely protested outside of Planned Parenthood facility there and had written on chalk that preborn Black Lives Matter and were also arrested. Simultaneously, the individuals that were involved in this felony level violence, prosecutors have already dropped a lot of the felony charges. hundreds upon hundreds of individuals who have not been arrested. And, just I think what's frustrating the American people, both in the enforcement of the public health measures, the restrictive public health measures, and also in just the general rule of law, is that, you know, if you're doing things that are deemed politically beneficial in their eyes or part of this higher cause that they subscribe to, there's a lot of forgiveness involved. And if you're doing something like, you know, going to church or maybe saying that we should have some fewer abortions than we do in this country, then, you know, there's no quarter spared.
Yeah, no. I mean, listen, and, you know, as we talk about this right now, Michael, I hate having to almost go there before I talk about honoring the people, but there is a big political point. Listen, everything that's going to happen between now and November 3rd is going to have a political overtone to it. You agree with that, Michael? I mean, there's no story that's not going to be tainted somehow or have a political overtone. And you can't have it both ways. You can't have it. I mean, they gave the president hell and continue to give him hell for the Tulsa rally. And in fact, there are even people on the left that are blaming that on Herman Cain's death and saying some pretty ugly things. So let's just understand the political environment we live in. I mean, it is highly toxic, and you've got this major election coming up, and everything's politicized. It's all, you know, everything's on the table. It's that kind of thing. Let me get right to the letter. I want to read this to you, Michael. I really was touched by this letter, though. Now, listen, I personally didn't know John Lewis specifically. I personally did know Herman Cain very well. I did not know John Lewis specifically on a personal level, only from a public per se. I think you knew John Lewis, right? I believe
I was on TV panels with him a few times.
Yeah. So you know better than I. But let me tell you what I do like.
And I met with him in the house.
My ideology would be far different than a John Lewis because of the politics involved. No question about it. But to me, as an American, I honor the man. I always honor the man, the woman, the man, the person. I think that's important to say. And I may not agree with everything, but that's what makes our country great, is we have a diversification of opinions and policy, which I say to people all the time out there. But here's the letter he wrote, which he sent to be published in the New York Times. We can learn something from his life and from this letter, and here it is, and I quote, "While my time here has now come to an end, I want you to know that in the last days and hours of my life, you inspired me," he said, "of the recent rallies in support of racial equality. You filled me with hope about the next chapter of our great American story when you used your power to make a difference in our society. Democracy is not a state. It is an act, and each generation must do its part to help build what we called the beloved community, a nation and world society at peace with itself. Now, ordinary people," he says, "will, with extraordinary vision, can redeem the soul of America by getting in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble." That's really about, to paraphrase here, keeping America honest, I think, is what Lewis is saying. He goes back to say, "Though I may not be here with you, I urge you to answer the highest calling of your heart and stand up for what you truly believe. In my life, I have done all I can to demonstrate that the way of peace, the way of love, and nonviolence." Let me say that again. The way of love and nonviolence is the more excellent way. Now it is your turn to let freedom ring. And he ends it with this: when historians pick up their pens to write the story of the 21st century, let them say that it was your generation who laid down the heavy burdens of hate at last, and that peace finally triumphed over violence, aggression, and war. So I say to you, walk with the wind, brothers and sisters, and let the spirit of peace and the power of everlasting love be your guide. And I'll tell you what, that letter was profound, Michael.
Well, particularly because of it, John Lewis was the practitioner of nonviolent opposition throughout his civil rights career. Amen. He was influenced very early on by Martin Luther King. I think he listened to Martin Luther King at the age of 15. He had met Rosa Parks by the time he was 17. He then met with Martin Luther King. He spoke at the famous I Have a Dream speech rally in Washington, D.C. In 63. And you know, was very influenced by that. In fact, there's a lot of compare and contrast that can be made between these two African-American icons that we celebrated this past week, because they both came to very different conclusions about what the impediments were to African-American advancement in this country. And I think they both were sincere in wanting to see the plight of African-Americans improved, but ideologically completely different. So obviously you have to celebrate John Lewis's, as I do, contribution to the civil rights movement. The political institution that he was up against at that time was George Wallace and Democrat political parties' embrace of segregation. Mm-hmm. And that was the battle he took on right away. He had, I think by the age of six, he had often said he'd seen only two white people in his whole life. He lived in, grew up in a very segregated community, went on, you know, through the Freedom Rider campaign and all of those initiatives, and routinely confronted law enforcement that was seeking to prevent these protests from spilling over. And famously, his, you know, skull was fractured in one of those scars on which his, you know, he carried for his entire life. And then, of course, the most famous of those encounters was the Edmund Pettus Bridge on the 1965 march, where he confronted, state troopers, and they were basically not able to advance. They didn't attack law enforcement. They didn't burn anything down. They didn't destroy any property. They sat down and prayed. And I think, if you're looking today for, you know, to play a part in what maybe is the final chapter of ending any racial prejudice in our country, you have to go back and look at the icons who had, not just because it's the more laudatory approach toward getting things done, but it's also proven to be the more successful way of getting things done. So no one can dispute Martin Luther King's effectiveness. What I don't like to see, and this did emerge, and you have to be, like, to be fair about John Lewis's legacy, you know, he ultimately, when he got to Congress, all of those adjectives of peace and tranquility and getting along with everybody, I wouldn't really say that was the political tactic he took in the House of Representatives. We had our own little encounter in the Tea Party movement with some allegations that were false from him. And, you know, he was a hugely partisan figure. I can remember the post 9/11 vote on the authorizing George W. Bush on the use of force that he described as the most difficult vote of his life. Well, in the eyes of most Americans, that was like probably the easiest vote, you know, to take. I mean, there's no doubt we had a terrorist movement that was plotting and engaged and openly bragging about their desire to destroy our country. And, and he had great trepidation. I did work with him on a few Africa issues. We both had similar aspirations. But again, you know, it's kind of like it's intriguing to see the way the left and right can kind of look at things very differently. But, he was very involved in Darfur. He was very involved with Mandela in the African National Congress after Mandela was released from prison. As I did, he traveled to Africa quite a bit. And so his focus wasn't even just exclusively on the domestic challenges, but on the plights of some of the most challenging countries of the world.
Well, I hope and pray that this is the final chapter, as you just penned a moment ago here and talked about, of racial inequality to the discussions of the levels we're having. But I think in his letter, I can support when he says the way of love and nonviolence. I like that. And now it's your turn to let freedom ring. I love that. But yet early on in the letter, when, you know, he talked about the rallies in support of racial equality, the problem is there are two different ways and views to look at this. The left tends to look at this ideologically, like the vandalism, the burning and the destruction. Somehow they turn the other cheek and turn the other way and they accept it. But part of that reason, Michael, is this. If you ask me, it's these people exactly who've indoctrinated and created a plantation for our brothers and sisters of Black American. They have, as my friend Reverend C.L. Bryant would say, and as Herman Cain would say exactly, two of my friends, They have created a plantation that is far and wide reaching to hold Black America back, and I have no issue with saying that. And so it is within the politics and the ideology of the left that has created this environment. And so I don't agree with the first part of that letter, that that is acceptable. I do prefer what you said, the civil rights and the Martin Luther King aspect and the ties that Lewis had to that. But when he says the nonviolence and love, yeah, I can support that. Absolutely. I think when you look at these two lives of John Lewis and Herman Cain, quite frankly, you're looking at really the diversity of America, but you're looking at the opinions of America. And all too often today, we lose sight of honoring people for their opinions. I have no issue with honoring the good things in John Lewis's life and Herman Cain, but we can do that and have civility without calling each other names
nasty. And I think what's become, absolutely, and that's got to be the goal. That's something that I've worked very diligently toward, and I think you would find most conservative leaders in this country are supportive of. It's also very challenging, and a big part of it is sort of this revisionist political history that is being propagated, in particularly in the 21st century, but even in the late 20th century, that seems to be totally escaping the reality that racial segregation and racism itself, including some of the most horrific racism in the KKK and elsewhere, was very closely linked to the Democrat Party. Now, that may not be the Democrat Party today, but Republicans are the party of Lincoln. Martin Luther King was pro-life. He believed in individual responsibility. Amen. He believed in, he rejected violence of all sorts as a means for obtaining political change. Yeah. In many respects, while it's always dangerous to sort of say, here's what this icon or that icon would say today, I cannot imagine, and I don't believe any studious onlooker of the civil rights movement would look at what's going on in the streets today and say that Martin Luther King would support that.
Listen, I've had a lot of conversation with Alveda King Jr. We've talked personally off mic many times.
Excellent woman.
We've talked on mic many times, but we've talked off mic many times. We've talked about our personal lives in different ways. And I'll tell you, she is a great representative for Martin Luther King. And she represents that family in an amazing way. And she would say exactly what you just said, Michael, and how that sets up to the civil rights fight of today. But again, there is this power struggle within the Socialist Democrat Party today that is where they're grasping for their, I believe what it is, Michael, they're grasping for their last breath of power. But I think what we're looking at, quite frankly, and I'll tell you right now, I think we're looking at the end of the Democrat Party. And I think we're looking at the rise of the Socialist Marxist Party in this country. What do you say to that?
It certainly seems to be where the momentum is and where things are headed. I think you have a Democrat establishment that's trying to maintain control. I think they exerted themselves clearly in the 16th presidential election in their support for Hillary Clinton. I think they exerted it again in 20. And I think it's why you have a lot on the far left who were probably more affiliated with Bernie Sanders and that wing of the party who feel maybe disempowered or disengaged from the political party that they are associated with. And I think there's a battle on for the heart and soul of the Democrat Party. And there's some important questions that have to be asked. I mean, you're not hearing them renounce socialism or talk about the costs of communism. You're not hearing them renounce socialist leaders of the world. I'm not hearing any real renouncement of the violence that's ongoing or the loss of life. We all know the name of the victim of the police brutality in Minneapolis. No one seems to know the names of these individuals who've been lost in Seattle and elsewhere through the violence and the anarchy that's been present.
Yeah.
But Herman Cain, who we also lost this past week, famously said that there's only one thing, that one person who's hated more than a conservative by the left, and that's an African-American conservative. And his belief was that exactly kind of what you were getting at, Malcolm, and that is that the inclination within the Democrat Party and within the left is that they need to have this monolithic grab of ethnicities that they can kind of cater to and manipulate, really, for the purposes of political gain. And I think part of the reason it's changing is that African Americans are not a monolithic group. An African American community is a gross oversimplification of an ethnicity that has a wide range of demographic and occupational and family and other challenges and issues in their life. And it's just, I think you're starting to see a logical diversification of political views within this, within African Americans. And I think that the left is hugely concerned and frightened by that.
Well, they were definitely scared of people like Herman Cain. You remember when Herman Cain was head in the presidential election with 999? He petrified them. You got to remember, everybody, this is before the Trump era. This was the, Michael, the business extraordinaire goes to Washington kind of story, you see? And that would have been, Herman Cain would have been the first in that realm if he had made it. But remember, he was high up in the polls and they did everything they could. Yeah, they took everything they could to take him down. They firepowered at him, did a full frontal assault on that man and tried to take him down by every way they can, which is why he said they have no problem going after a black conservative. That doesn't fit their look of the plantation. You know that, Michael. That
was the rest of that quote that I was just giving you. But, you know, Herman Cain, who obviously was a huge champion of our Tea Party movement, he spoke at 15 or 20 events. It kind of served as a foundation for the launch of his 2012 presidential candidacy, you know, also had an incredible degree of success in American business, starting out, you know, as an analyst of a few, you know, pizza stores for Godfathers in Philadelphia, ultimately rising to be president and CEO of that company when it was part of Pillsbury, and then acquiring that company in a leveraged buyout. Very different, you know, kind of early life than John Lewis's, and you can see how maybe some of these experiences led them to different conclusions about the impediments, because Herman Cain ultimately came to the conclusion that taxes and regulations were very much the impediment to African-American advancement, and put forward in the 999 plan and others a lot of solutions for that.
Well, I'll tell you what, I have to tell you now that on a personal note for me, a moment, if you would mind me, is that I will miss very much Herman Cain, very much. I had many conversations with him, both on and off the mic and the camera. I've interviewed him several times. In fact, I want to tell folks that I've released excerpts of the multiple television programs I've recorded with him as a host of my program of Malcolm Out Loud. And I've released multiple excerpts of the man. I mean, and I'm talking vintage Herman Cain here. And in fact, one of the mentions I put in one of the tweets out there and on all social media, actually, I put this on all channels, on Gab and Parler, LinkedIn, all of them, is where he's just right now, I believe, as I've referenced, that Herman Cain is in heaven and he has them all laughing right now, because that's what he was. Herman Cain.
He was never in a bad mood. The guy was never in a bad mood. He always had this big smile on his face, and you never knew what challenges he was facing. And I'm sure he was facing them, but boy, he was always in a good mood. And he was an inspiring person who could bring a crowd to their feet. And he was an inspirational force within the Tea Party movement. And you know, he was very, 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 as you correctly point out, a very compelling presidential candidate who came close.
I wish he would have won it. He'd have been a great president. I said that in a tweet as well. He made a great president.
He would have been much better than Mitt Romney.
Yes. I believe I have I've had some of the best moments with Herman on camera. And again, I'm releasing those excerpts this weekend in memory of Herman Cain, friends. So please see them, the video excerpts out there that I put out. And they're only like a minute or two or three, just excerpts I've pulled from the hours that I've interviewed him on air. And anyways, I love the man. I just want to tell you, with Herman Cain, rest in peace, brother. We'll see you on the other side. And I can't thank Herman Cain enough for all the memories in so many ways in this life. And I know you speak about that as well, Michael, and knowing the man.
Definitely.
As you did. But I just, I have a personal relationship with him, and he really has touched my heart, my soul, and my life in ways that it's hard to define right here, people. But if you see the moments we had on camera, you'll sort of get it. We had some great laughs and some great times, and he was a remarkable man and a great human being. And I'll leave you with this thought here, people. He was the best of America, and he is what unites us as a people. And I get excited about that because, to me, that is what America is about. It's the diversification and the uniqueness of our nation. It's what makes America so beautiful, is that shining city on a hill is an example of all that is good. That's what Herman Cain represented. And God love it. We will miss him for sure. He leaves an incredible legacy of work, but you just, it's a vacuum that'll be impossible to fill for what he has given in this lifetime. So amen. And again, keeping it all clean here, people, keeping it all good. God bless both Representative John Lewis and the extraordinary Herman Cain, both of them, for their contributions in this society. And hopefully, Michael, to what you say, this is a chapter that America will finally, I pray to God, and maybe we can do that in Lewis's and Cain's name, get over this chapter. That would be a beautiful thing, Michael, if there was a way to get that all put together and really bring this forward. God, there's got to be a way to make that happen. Anyways, a lot
to say.
Well,
it's kind of interesting because they did have similar objectives, I think, as it relates to the plight of African Americans. And they also shared, if you want to look for any commonality, because there's not a lot, honestly, ideologically. But the other commonality is they both believed in grassroots political activism. John Lewis saw it in the civil rights movement. Herman Cain was one of those first people that was on the phone with many of us talking about how he could be helpful in offering this support when God knows we needed support and help.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me just tell folks here, you're listening here to Viewpoint Presents. We are on America Out Loud Talk Radio. It's wonderful to be with you here today. Thank you for inviting us into your home and your lives, people, and my fellow Americans, and we appreciate you very much. You're here with Malcolm Michael Johns. I just want to remind you all that the network, the program, is the second hour of our big brand on Viewpoint. So it's 2 hours now of Viewpoint. It starts with Viewpoint this Sunday, and then Viewpoint Presents is really a deep dive into the topics with Michael Johns and Malcolm here, and we're just thrilled to have you with us. Now, we ask you to help us get the word out there with the program. The program, again, will run from 10 to noontime, 2 hours again, so that you get it right at 11, but 10 is Viewpoint this Sunday. So just look at it as a 2-hour invitation to join us, please, is what I would love to invite you to do. 10 to 12 on Sunday. And then we come back for an encore later that day on America Out Loud Talk Radio, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And again, that's going to be earlier on the West Coast, of course, on any time zone. You can hear us worldwide on our world-class media player. You can hear us on iHeartRadio, many other networks, but also get more intimate with us on our apps, Apple, Android, or Alexa. And those apps are free, and we have a great family of app holders, and so I hope you'll get the app and become part of the family here. We invite you to do that. All shows go to podcast Sunday afternoon. I'm talking about Viewpoint this Sunday. Viewpoint Presents, the entire Viewpoint brand, you'll find on podcast at America Out Loud. We're going to take on a little bit more of the election now. The very interesting Rasmussen poll as well, and some other major points of this election with the mail-in voting, absentee voting, just after this quick pause. Be back in just a moment.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
American Democracy in Action. Viewpoint presents Election 2020.
So we join you back here on Viewpoint Presents here. And so this Rasmussen poll, Michael, that we started to hint about a little bit earlier in the program, is very interesting in how they position with the president in the election. I want you to tell people about it because it's a daily tracking poll. It's one of a kind, actually, and they show approval about 50%. That's right. Is that right?
Yeah, Rasmussen is the only polling agency now doing the daily approval rates of the president, which I think are hugely important. And they're, you know, July 31, the most recent one that I have, has approval rate of Trump at 50%. And I don't believe he's been over 50% much, you know, within the last couple of years. So it's very suggestive of the fact that the 63 million base certainly is all still there for the president and likely to come out. And these polls that, you know, show Biden up 6 points, 8 points, 10 points, some more than that, are probably as unreliable, frankly, as the ones that showed 2016. Hillary Clinton winning in 2016 A week before. And yet, you know, the issue is still undecided. I mean, it's totally unfair and unreasonable, I think, for anyone to say at this point that, oh, Biden's going to win or, oh, Trump's going to win. Well, we had, like, you know, 3 months here of developments with a couple national crises on our hands. And then the question of the president's communication strategy, which I believe is that I know for a fact is at a crossroads. You know, I think that you're going to start to see some different messaging out from the president. And there's some really important decisions to make because there's about 10 different ways to go after winning this race. And you can't do it 10 different ways. You got to ultimately settle on one or two kind of core messages.
Michael, what's the latest on the debates that we're hearing?
Well, they're up to now unscheduled. Biden wants to do them remotely. Doesn't want to be in Trump's presence. No shocker there. Wow. I think that's all part of a political tactic, and I think their side is terrified of it. You know, you just can't help without, you know, not getting into any clinical diagnosis of Joe Biden, but if you know, I just can't see how anyone's looking at his recent remarks, some of which are teleprompter based, and he's still being bumbling just about every one of them in major ways that like, and not conclude that something is not right here and almost forget the partisanship behind it. Is it really a service to the country or even to the Democrat Party to be leading this man into this candidacy, knowing that this is the most difficult and demanding job in the world?
They don't want Trump and Biden in the same room, clearly, Michael, but they don't even want them, you know, in the same talking point if they can help it, right?
I also, you know, the other thing is I can't, maybe I'm overlooking anything, but I can't recall any presidential candidate in our lifetime, at least, who is committed only to one term. I mean, he's sort of acknowledging he's not good for any more than 4 years. And of course, I'm suggesting I'm not sure he's good for 4 years. But that, I can't imagine that's politically advantageous either to sort of go into it saying, hey, I'm not up to any, 2024 reelection campaign.
Well, I'd like to go one step further, if you don't mind. And I'd like to say I will make an assertion. I not only believe he's not good for 4 years, I believe he's not good for 4 months or 4 weeks, is what I would say, my friend. And I do not believe, and listen, this is to take nothing away from dementia or Alzheimer's. They are terrible diseases that I pray every day that we find a cure for these. I really do. And I never want this to affect anybody. But clearly this man, not only is his politics wrong and his ideology, and socialism is not an offering that a majority of Americans are interested in, but the fact that he is not able to handle the job physically and mentally, I think is a decider in itself, Michael. I suspect this is going to be a very difficult election.
Yeah, and that's going to obviously raise the question. You know, so I think if you're in the Trump administration in the White House right now, or if you're in the campaign, you're well aware that there's all these deficiencies of Biden. Do you go aggressively after that or not? That's kind of a strategic question. You know, the guy's been in federal politics at the highest levels for 47 years. I don't think anyone could name one significant accomplishment of him. Do you go after that? Coronavirus is also an intriguing political question because, as you just heard from me and you've heard previously from me, I believe this president's done a very credible presentable job in managing this pandemic from China. And yet, I think there's some question, like, do you lead with talking about all the things you've done when you still have to concede the fact that 150,000 people, as of, present tense, are lost to this. And that's a difficult question. But I think you want to go into November 3 with the having communicated the magnitude of effort across public health, across clinical research, across economic relief, all of these broad, multi-interagency, interdepartmental, task force-oriented initiatives that this administration's been bogged down with now for months.
And as we talked about earlier as well, I wanted to touch on the, we did touch on it, but I was hoping we had more time. We're going to run right out of time. But regarding the absentee vote-in, which is very proper and legal, rightfully so, and versus this blanketed universal mail-in vote-in, which the president started in that tweet, Michael, that seems to be, from everything I've seen and the research I've done, looking at the various states around the country here, that is going to be one of the biggest controversial points into the election. And, you know, there are reports now that we may not be able to call the election on November 3rd that evening, or November 4th for that matter. This thing may go some weeks beyond that because the USPS is saying they need a 2-week window to be able to turn any of that stuff around. What do you think about that story?
I don't think we have the infrastructure capability to be even saying or discussing it seriously as an option. And I see no reason why, with all of the activities that are occurring, that we cannot have a very well-managed presence at the polls with masks and distancing and, different pens or whatever, all the protective measures that are necessary should be reasonable to be able to put in place. And, given the magnitude of problems that have existed in these universal, and it was played out again in these primaries, I talked to you earlier about the New York examples. Yeah. There is zero basis to believe that this could be held in a free and fair and accurate
way. I think it's not. I think there were real questions. Maybe at first we hesitated, but I don't think there's any hesitation right now.
Here's the partisan part of it. Since I think we're trying going into this election, you and I, to look at some of the political dimensions of things, Malcolm, is that you have an Emerson College poll that looked at, for individuals who are inclined to vote by mail versus those who are inclined to vote in person. For in person, Trump 65%, Biden 32%, mm-hmm. and then by mail, Biden 76%, Trump 20%.
And that explains a lot, doesn't it? Right there,
Also, 58% in this Emerson College poll are inclined to vote in person, 43% by mail. And it kind of contradicts some of the demographics too, since the president's been pretty popular with the older demographic,
listen,
that you would think.
There's a lot more I want to talk to you about all of this. And let's say this to listeners, that over the weeks and months ahead, we'll have you covered on a lot of this because we'll bring this analysis to you. We're going to be right on the front lines of all of this, Michael, between now and certainly the 3rd of November and thereafter. We've made the election 2020 a big pivotal point of our program here, and we want to get our country properly positioned and over the hurdles here. But there's a lot more information I've got. I want to talk about the red and blue state strategies, some of the numbers you're talking about, and let's get everybody informed to the best of our abilities here. We'll continue to do that, friends, for you here on Viewpoint Presents and the Viewpoint brand. Listen, thank you always for being part of the mission here. It's an important mission. It's one, again, to preserve our liberties and preserve this great country and all that we love and hold cherish here, our values. Now, thank you again, friends. It's time to get involved and get loud.